Welcome to the Varsity Theater. Welcome to Policy in a Pint. This is our last Policy in a Pint of the year, but the second of our new season here that is made possible by Target Corporation. We're calling this entire season State of the State. So we're looking at lots of different issues concerning the state of Minnesota all throughout the next 12 months. And we're very excited about all these. And this one in particular is going to be really cool tonight to talk about how art and fostering a healthy arts culture affects metropolitan cores and cities and our quality of life in general. I want to thank, of course, before we get any further, thanks to the Citizens League, our partner in Policy in a Pint. Round of applause for the Citizens League, absolutely, for almost 9 years running now. Sean Kershaw, their intrepid leader. And also, again, thanks to Target for being our corporate sponsor this year. So we know the Twin Cities are a great place to live when it comes to art and culture, obviously, right? I mean, we've got one of the best music scenes in the country, full stop. Theater and performance from the Guthrie to the Fringe Festival. The Walker is world class. We have two Grammy-winning orchestral ensembles here. We somehow intrinsically have this hunch that this stuff makes our community better. But why do we think that? Is it just because we dig the arts here, or it gives us this this sense of superiority over cities that are just as healthy economically, but whose arts scenes are lacking? Is there a connection between economic health and the role that arts and culture have to making a city a great place to work and call home? And is this measurable? Is this quantifiable? Is there proof to this? So that's what we're sort of talking about tonight. Before I introduce my guests, I want to encourage you to tweet about this as well. It's hashtag PolicyPint. I might even be able to share your tweets. If you have some, if you'd rather ask a question in the form of a tweet, rather than from the audience, we could do it that way. And it'll even encourage me to use Twitter. I'm terrible about doing it. But so here's how the show works. I will talk to our guests for, if you've never been to a Policy in a Pint, I talk to our guests for about 20, 30 minutes, and then we go out in the audience and I take your questions. And the only rule is I hold the mic, no grabbing the mic from me, and soapboxing, grandstanding, you might get in a good 20 seconds. After that, no, pretty much not speeches, I guess. Questions. Awesome. But we do want to mix it up tonight. I got an email from somebody on Friday saying, it sure sounds like you're going to be a cheerleader for my tax dollars being spent on the arts. Where is my view going to be represented? By the way, I will not be attending Monday's event. I'm so sorry about that, because I really do want to get that discussion going. And I sound all sarcastic about that, but I'm completely serious, because if we're just cheerleading for this, then it's not as interesting as it could be. Gulgun Kayum is she began her position as Director of the Arts, Culture, and Creative Economy with the City of Minneapolis 2 years ago, July 2011. She works with the Minneapolis Arts Commission and develops arts, culture, and creative industry policies around economic development programs and the city. She has an extensive background and professional experience in performance and public art and art installation, producing and creating large-scale public artworks and theatrical performances in dance and theater. And I have one in particular that I'm going to ask her about that I'm fascinated by in just a minute here. Actually, maybe you know what I'm going to get to. Laura Zabel is Executive Director of Springboard for the Arts, an economic and community development agency based in Minnesota. Perhaps you're familiar as well. Springboard, she's... Springboard for the Arts, getting catcalls tonight. Awesome, yes. Springboard provides programs that help artists make a living and life, and programs that help communities tap into the resource that artists provide. And some of Springboard's projects include such things as some community-supported art. I'm going to ask her specifically about that, based on the agricultural CSA model. So we're going to talk about that and other things tonight. Peter Leggett, we're very, very happy to have here tonight. He started playing drums at age 9. These days he plays for High Respects, He's also performed with the likes of Atmosphere, Mason Jennings, POS, Kid Dakota, and others. He's executive director of Walker West Music Academy, a 25-year-old community music school located on Selby Avenue in St. Paul. And he's also chairman of the City of St. Paul Cultural Star Board and also the board secretary of the Selby Avenue Action Coalition. So we're very appreciative of all of our guests being here tonight. A round of applause for all of our guests for joining us this evening. Gulgun, Joe Spencer told me about Joe Spencer, who is sort of your St. Paul analog, I suppose. He's kind of the sort of in a way, because he's kind of the arts ambassador for Mayor Coleman, I suppose, in the city of St. Paul. He was telling me about a performance art piece that you had something to do with that was that happened in a cab. Or not a cab, but a moving vehicle. Is that right? What is that? Are you like never living this down? Is that why you do this?
Yeah.
Okay, so please tell, and please a reminder to all our guests to just sort of be close to the mic here if you can. So this was like the smallest scale performance kind of piece that there could possibly be, right?
He outed me. It was actually I am one of the co-founders of a small collective of performing artists. And we do performances outside of theater spaces. Right. And it was called The Car, and it performed in three different cars that drove around downtown. And one was a taxi and told the story of the taxi cab driver. And one was called The Prostitute, and I'll leave that to your imagination. And the third was called A Wild Ride, a bunch of people, partygoers on their way to the gay 90s. And the audience was in the back seat.
So you could the audience could only be as big as the people who could fit into the back seat
exactly.
of the car.
Exactly, and it was about intimacy.
Sure.
So it was about intimacy in the urban environment, trying to find where do we get intimate and tell stories.
Was the person responsible for driving the car one of the performers or just
yes.
the driver? Okay, yes. So there was the driver, and then the other person in the front seat was the only other performer. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, and it depended on the size of the car. So with the Wild Ride, we had a big Lincoln Town Car, so uh-huh. there were three people in the front. Yeah,
can you,
that was a big. That was
so
a big
what if you didn't like it? Could you get
well,
out of the? Could
actually,
you request a stop?
Each car had a stage manager. So there was a car following, tailing the car that was performing.
Uh-huh.
And if anybody said, I've got to stop, get out, then they would get into the stage manager.
Was there a safe word you could say, to get out of the performance?
They could
say stop. You say stop, right,
yeah.
Okay.
And it would stop. And in fact, there is actually one incident when halfway through the performance, one car did break down. And
did you incorporate that into the drama of the
No, they just called the stage manager's car, who showed up and picked up everybody and took the audience back home while the actors had to wait for the tow truck.
Awesome.
This was years ago, you understand.
No, I know, and you're still talking about it to this day, right? Well,
it was
thank
a big
Joe Spencer
hit.
For that.
We sold out right away.
Oh, really? You had so many seats to fill on that.
Well,
right.
Actually, it ran for an entire month.
Did it really?
Yeah, and it was quite a thing.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the economy, it's usually in terms of manufacturing, jobs, education. So how do arts and culture fit in? So I want our guests to sort of set the scene for us first on how the arts are a barometer of a healthy economy in a community. So Laura, I'll throw that to you first.
Sure. I think for me it's important to think about that sort of at all levels and in a whole spectrum. So on the sort of giant macro end of the scale, the National Endowment for the Arts just last week released for the first time ever the portion of the GDP that's made up by the arts and culture in the United States, which is over $500 billion and over 3% of our total GDP. But that's a really big, giant, abstract way of thinking about it. And so I think all the way at the other end of that spectrum is a band playing in a bar, and the way that that drives receipts for that bar for that night, the way that it brings people and attention and dollars to individual places. And so I think, and then of course, at every place in between, I think the arts and culture intersect with our economy and our community and how we feel about it.
And Peter, I've already, you've had practice in answering this question already because I had you on the morning show on Friday, so.
Yeah, I think that what was really interesting about that study, too, is that they said that it had overcome tourism, right? So mm-hmm. it was even bigger than tourism.
Bigger than the airline industry as well.
Right, right. You know, I think one of the things that I think about is the Knight Foundation did this study here, the Soul of the Community, and they surveyed, you know, 43,000 people over 3 years in 26 communities, and what they found is that there were these three kind of core components that they found really impacted the quality of life in the city, and those were social offerings and overall aesthetics and the openness of a community. And I think that what that study showed is that increases people's attachment to cities and that you can actually show measurable GDP growth. So I think that's a great example of, you know, when we have kind of vibrant arts communities, that it's places where people want to stay more engaged and more involved, and you can see that can actually help a community grow.
List those things for me again.
Yeah, so it's
a little, yeah, closer to the mic.
Yeah, so it's aesthetics, kind of how the city feels, the openness that residents have to the general public, and then social offerings is the third one.
So, Gulgun, how would you say? Yeah, we've covered some good answers here so far, but.
Well, I totally agree with my colleagues here, and my view of it is that it's both social and economic, so it's both impacts, because the arts are one of these sectors that are both produce hard results, so in terms of jobs. I did a study for Minneapolis in particular, and we found that the arts jobs or the creative sector jobs were 5% of all jobs, so that's pretty significant. So all those kind of hard numbers, those are the economics. And then they're the social capital, which is you're at an art event, you meet somebody, and you connect, and then you go away, and you create something else with that person. So the social capital piece is really hard to measure. It's really hard to, and that's the Knight Foundation study there. It's really hard to define, and yet it has so much. It's very important for cities in terms of stimulating innovation and thinking. So I would say that social and economic impacts are really, the way I view it, it's both.
So it seems to me that, like I said, we all kind of intuit that a successful arts community is going to be successful in other ways. It's going to be successful economically. I can't think of too many examples that's not the case. I know that there's probably a significant exception in the form of Detroit, because I know that there's a kind of growing arts scene there, but that may be the super outlier kind of because of the other circumstances. I don't know. I mean, maybe you have something to say about that, but it seems to me that in general, we kind of intuit that there's a kind of correlation between art and health. And I wonder, is that because we sense that there's a correlation between art being a measure of disposable income in a city, the more disposable income that there is, or if there's there's a one-to-one relationship between art and the level of education in a city? Has there ever been research towards that kind of thing?
I think some of those things you just said are true, although I also think that Detroit is a really great example of when a city is in crisis, when a community is in crisis, we turn to what is fundamental, and art and culture and our creative expression is the sort of fundamental human need. And so when you go to Detroit now, some of the most exciting things that are happening in that city are small, DIY, scrappy, really artist-driven, you know, entrepreneurship. And I have a friend who does a lot of work in Detroit, who lives in Detroit, and he says that the next big thing in Detroit is 1,000 little things. And I think that kind of energy that comes from our need to express ourselves, our need to say something about the situation that we're in, to me, that's the core of why we have that gut level feeling that it's important to our places, because we all have that need.
So I guess the million dollar question then is that something that it could drive change in Detroit? Art itself, because that seems rather quixotic to me, because I'd like to believe it, but anybody else want to jump in on that?
I think that I'm not sure that art itself can. I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'm not sure, because
good night, everybody. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No, because it really, I mean, You can look at the activity on one level, but you can look at what spurs that activity.
Right.
So in our community, I mean, everything is very specific to the place, I would say. So it's really hard for me to compare Detroit to Minneapolis, mm-hmm. because the way art was developed in Minneapolis had a lot to do with the development of the milling industry, the lumber industry, mm-hmm. all these, you know, big, you know, foundations of the state. And the philanthropy that now comes out of that wealth is how we actually get a lot of benefits from the arts, especially in the nonprofit sector. I would say in Detroit, the issues around Detroit are really about people trying to be creative with less. And artists are really good at that because artists know what that feels like. Mostly when people leave the arts, unless you're going to go into some sort of for-profit activity, you're not going to make a return on your education investment. Because if you want to do work, non-profit, let's say, you're going to have to give something up. It's very hard to make a living as an artist and stay in the for-profit sector. So you have to be creative. You have to have multiple income streams, for example. And I would say that we're examples of multiple income streams sitting at this table here, right?
Right.
We all have other lives. So in Detroit, the reason I think artists might be at the maybe at the hub of leading the way, but not going to be the answer necessarily, is because they know how to make something from nothing, because they've done it before.
Okay.
But I'm not sure if they'll lead the way, because unless there's heavy investment in it, I'm not sure that it
right.
can really be scaled.
Okay, you know? So that's one of the big things we're going to talk about, is investment in the arts and what has been done, and you alluded to some of that as well, and what should be, what one should continue to do, assuming we accept that premise, that is what is going to help feed into a successful economy. Unless you have something to say about Detroit, I want to kind of move on, because that's another sort of side light. I think I sort of steered us over there, and I want to get us back to our immediate environs. So let's go ahead and accept that premise, that arts simply make a positive impact on the health of a community. How does the community cultivate an art scene? And you talked about there's a long history of, because of what was successful economically here before, the milling industry, all that kind of stuff, it created wealth, it created philanthropy. Is that perhaps is that the kind of prerequisite really that by and large cities need wealth first?
No, you need investment. You need some sort of investment. Investment really helps.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, in this country, arts don't have a strong basis of support from the government. So you need some kind of investment to spur innovation that are at the core of arts activity. You could of course not invest and let a for-profit environment happen, and then you get things, you know, that are never really develop and become innovative. So you can get things
and become
like,
what? I'm sorry?
Develop or become innovative.
No, innovative kind of.
Yeah, so I mean, I look at the arts as a spectrum where you can go and see the same show every year, you know, Christmas Carol every year. And that, it, to me, is more delivering a product that's delivering security. Or you can look at arts that are about trying to find out what the future will be. And that's more about innovation. And that's where I'm saying investments often lie in the philanthropy sector, is looking at arts as an innovator for other things. And I think, I mean, especially what Laura's doing at Springboard, that kind of work is where, you know, where the energy lies.
So let's let you guys jump in here on how we cultivate an arts scene, you know, because there's the kind of thing that happens organically. I don't really know that, because to me, I consider everything, as I listed at the beginning of the show and as I did on, you know, the promos that we're running on The Current for 2 weeks, you know, I consider, and before I ever even moved here, I always thought the art scene, I thought of The Walker and The Replacements as being the same thing. I mean, it's like, this is why living in Minneapolis is what I want. That's why I'm going to move there, is because, you know, that's the community that sounds like where I want to live. And but, you know, those things, it seems to me, can't have come from the same kind of place, or can they? Is it climate, or, you know, not, you know, weather, but the tone of a city that sort of creates things out of some kind of collective inertia? I know that's kind. You know what I'm saying? That's a bit inspiration, right? That's a bit diffuse, probably. But let's talk about the various ways that you cultivate an art scene. Basically, is the question.
I mean, I think it's a lot of different things. I think I agree that there's kind of nationally in the U.S. there's not as much of a importance placed on the arts, but I think that that's changing. I think in Minnesota we're actually very fortunate to have a very robust kind of state arts board budget that's second only to New York State. And the next in line is then New Jersey, and ours is something like twice as much as New Jersey's entire arts board budget. And you have that level of investment going in at a state level. And then you have regional arts councils. There's 11 of those throughout the state that can invest into more rural areas. You have a lot of philanthropy that's happening. So I think, you know, from that kind of public and private investment coupled with just kind of other opportunities for government spending, I think that, you know, those are really impactful and can kind of create the perfect environment where when you get creative types who are kind of shut up for the winter and need to find something to do, that, you know, they have the opportunity to, you know, really practice their craft and also have opportunities to gain income from their craft and also be able to share it at venues and galleries and a lot of things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes from those kind of investments and those investments come from a culture of caring about those things. I mean, to me, I think this doesn't always happen, but in an ideal world, we should consider the Walker and the Replacements part of one ecosystem of what makes a healthy, desirable place to live, as we should church choirs and people who draw with chalk on their sidewalk in front of their house. I think that spectrum of opportunity and multiple entry points into arts and culture are what make it feel vibrant. Because as wonderful as our institutions are, our big institutions, lots of cities have big institutions. So it really is the sort of neighborhood-based, place-based stuff that makes this place feel specific and desirable. And I think that comes from a culture. I mean, Peter, talking about the State Arts Board, the constitutional amendment that we passed, the legacy amendment, I describe that to people outside of Minnesota as a quality of life amendment. It was Minnesotans collectively saying, we care about the environment here, we care about our lakes, we care about our culture. Those are the things that make this Minnesota, and so we need to support them collectively. And for me, it's much more exciting and much more healthy to consider art and culture as one part of a whole set of things that a state or a city or a community need to be healthy, rather than sort of siloed off and with its own separate system of support and engagement.
Go ahead.
I would add one more thing to that, and I see as crucial is education. Because for me, again, thinking at it from the solely the economic standpoint, or maybe the social too, but that if you're not focused on educating kids at all levels, including college, you're not producing the future audiences or artists. You've shut that down. So it's a system that really needs to feed itself. And that's one thing that I'd get very concerned about when I see arts education or some sort of interaction in the educational environment with the arts shut down.
So I want to take the libertarian angle here, basically, and that is why do we need the arts for a healthy economy? I grew up in Tampa, Florida. It's a very economically healthy area. Tampa, Central Florida, Orlando is. There's more art, I think, in a tire store in Minneapolis than there is in the entirety of Hillsborough County, Florida. But I know you got to get my Florida dig in at least once a day. But seriously, why art?
Well, because you don't live there anymore.
Right. Well, I don't. I don't. But that's the thing, is that that's something that I elected to do, was to live here. Make the argument to me why my tax dollars should be, you just said that we have the, you know, third behind New York State and New Jersey, or is it second?
Second.
Second behind New York State. So why is that something that I should tolerate if I don't believe, you know?
Yeah,
I don't believe in it.
And this is a good conversation to have. This is a good argument, and I think that anybody who's ever been touched by any piece of art, I think that's the argument that you could make. Even the most kind of, I mean, it can be a very kind of divisive, kind of politicized debate, but I think anybody who's had an experience with music or visual art or poetry or literature, I mean, that's the argument right there, that, you know, the capacity that it has to really impact people's lives.
So you're going to bring it down to a quality of life issue that's really about, because that's kind of a spiritual argument. You know, that's a sort of, you know what I'm saying?
I think there's definitely that spiritual argument, but I think there is a hardcore economic argument that you did illustrate perfectly. Like, if the future of our cities is about talent retention, and if we live in an environment now where young people are making decisions about where to live, not based on a job, but based on where they want to live, then cities that want to be competitive are going to have to attract talent. They're going to have to attract people who want to live there.
I completely agree with these guys. And I would say I'm not a sports fan. And and if we're going to have a diverse community with lots of interests served, then you have to have something for those people that want to have arts as well. So if my tax dollars goes towards sports, I better have something in the arts sector, because I don't go to sports events.
So, yeah, and nor do I. And I that's why I'm dialed in with you on that.
But you know,
you and I are outnumbered in that degree. Probably.
Maybe not.
Well, yeah, and again, that says something about the community here, because this is potentially the exception in America, not the rule.
I just did a comparison to sports in the measure that I did, and in terms of spending. Just consumer spending in the sports, and art spending is 70% of sports spending, and we don't have the venues that that sports stadia do, nor the investment, nor the level of investment.
So spending by the end users, by the consumers.
People buying tickets to events, uh-huh. Right. And so we don't have the giant stadiums. The biggest one is 2,000 seats at the Guthrie. So I would argue that there's a lot of return on very little investment.
Can everybody hear everybody okay, by the way? Can you hear Gulgun all right? A little closer to the mic, probably, Gulgun,
okay.
I think. Peter, do you want to jump on this?
Yeah, I was going to agree with that. I mean, I think that it does have a really measured economic impact. I know that St. Paul has something like the economic footprint of the arts and cultural organizations is like $800 million, or I'm sorry, $300 million, I believe. And it has something to do with, I think, 8,200 jobs that are created by arts and cultural organizations. And I think that, you know, that's a huge demonstration of, you know, kind of the direct impact. And no, it's not the same as, you know, the sports stadium, but that's keeping a lot of people moving and keeping a really, I think, vibrant city.
Before I jump into this thing that's looking at me here, because this apparently is a document of actual numbers. Laura, did you have anything?
No,
this is Gulgun's
bailiwick. Sorry.
Right here. All right, look, it says the Minneapolis Creative Index 2013. Is that the Creative Vitality Index I've been reading about?
The Creative Vitality Index is the data, so the index is the report. So there's actually an organization called the Western States Arts Federation that aggregates this data and delivers it annually. So I bought into that aggregation and index, and so the report is mine, whereas the index is the data. So just
okay.
Kind of separate those.
I'm going to go start to take some questions here. So again, kindly remember the rules. But if you do want to impassionedly argue against all of this, bleeding heart enthusiasm that we have going here, please step up, and because I want to hear your argument. So let's see some hands of who wants to ask some questions and get in on the conversation. Oh, come on. All right, we have one here to start first. Don't wait until the last 5 minutes, because I know your questions are in there.
Thank you for being here tonight. We're talking a lot about audiences and artists, and I was curious if anyone had any comment on art as like an enjoyable means to an end. So the connection between music education, for example, and mathematics scores. Or music education and foreign language in a world of globalization and competing as a nation.
Great question. Awesome.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research out there that demonstrates that, you know, arts education does impact SAT scores. It does impact graduation rates. I know that the Department of Justice even did a study about the impact of arts education for lower socioeconomic students
and that it could positively impact pro-social behavior. So I think, you know, there's a lot of research, and I think that's one of the interesting things about the time that we live in, is that we have all this data, all this information that, you know, policymakers can use and the private sector can kind of use. So, you know, I think those are some of those examples.
I know that Jill and I talked about this on the morning show within the past month as well, and I unfortunately can't cite what the source was, but there was a study that was published somewhere recently that basically said that it sort of put to rest the question, well, kids who, for example, go into a band or, you know, learn to play the clarinet, go into whatnot, they seem to do sort of categorically better on, you know, math and science and reading and whatnot. Could this possibly be because they are kids who are already advantaged in some other way and they just so happen to get into music as well? And this study essentially said, it removed all those other variables, basically, and said, no, it does seem to be an actual, not just correlation, but a causation between, you know, being involved in music, basically. And this study was funded by the Liberal Bleeding Hearts Club, I believe. No, it wasn't. It was some reputable organization, and I can't think of what it was, and so thus it's worthless information, probably.
Well, two things. One, as somebody who teaches mathematics through art to the math avoidant art students, I have to commend the earlier comments. I was curious about the benefits and costs of gentrification that often follows arts development or art district development.
I think that's a really important question. It's something we think and talk about and work on a lot in our work. So, just in case anybody doesn't know this sort of trope, it's that artists move into a community, the property values go up, the artists get pushed out along with everyone else who lived in that community before the artists show up. I think, first of all, it's important to root any conversation about that in an actual place and an actual neighborhood, because neighborhoods aren't the same, and what is true in Brooklyn is not true necessarily here or in a small community in rural Minnesota. But I do think that those are really important things to wrestle with. I think that some of the stuff that Peter talked about in that Knight Foundation study about what attaches people to community, and that feeling that sense of agency and connection and opportunity in your community is perhaps more important even than the job or the safety or those kinds of things. And so I think that art can be used as a tool to build that kind of agency, to make sure that people feel ownership and engagement and power in their own community. Unfortunately, sometimes artists also get used in the opposite way, which of course I think people are coming around to the idea that that is not the way to go about building neighborhoods for long-term economic health. But it's still definitely a concern. I think a great example here locally is an organization called ArtSpace that buys property and then leases it to artists, and they are a nonprofit and they hold that property in perpetuity. So where our office is in Lower Town in downtown St. Paul is a great example of a neighborhood that's going through tremendous change, tremendous development. But because ArtSpace has been there, the buildings in which the artists live have been protected. And so even with all of that development, we've been able to really retain this creative artistic core of the community.
And one thing to also remember is that artists rarely own the buildings in which they're living, unless, of course, ArtSpace has enabled that or some other organization. And it's the property developers, it's the people who own the properties that raise the rents. So what people are experiencing are a phenomenon where they see the wave of artists coming into areas that they can afford, and they're investing in those places, and then it's that trend that people kind of identify with the arts, and I'd say, you know, it's artists are not creating the trend. It's people who are taking advantage of that are raising the rents. You know, and I think everyone wants to live in a community that's functional, you know, good to be around, safe, etc. Artists should be in there, as anyone should be in there. So it's really, that's at the root of some really serious issues that I think could have some public policy implications.
Yeah. And I think you're, in some ways, I think we're seeing some evidence that there's kind of a pivot happening and more of an emphasis on making sure that redevelopment comes from the community and that artists are engaged. I mean, you know, I think models like the land trust model, I think we're gonna see a lot more of that type of investment so that we can keep the property values down and that we can kind of retain ownership in a community while still getting kind of the revitalization that we wanna see. But it's definitely a very kind of contentious, you know, contended issue for sure.
Before I get to this next question, actually, I wanna ask you as well, Laura, about the art CSAs, because I found this to be such a curious phenomenon. So. Is everyone familiar with the idea of the food CSA, basically? Let me raise your hand if you're not, basically. Okay, so Laura, explain this whole thing, starting with the food CSA thing, and then segue into the art CSA.
Sure. So for all of the reasons that we've been talking about today, Springboard, where I work, we had been talking for a long time about the parallels between the local food movement and local culture and local art, and sort of looking at what has happened in relationship to local food and thinking, gee, there's a lot that's really relevant and useful and a lot of common goals there. So we looked at community-supported agriculture as just a really wonderful model for connecting community members directly with producers. And we said, well, why can't we do that for art? Why can't there be community-supported art? So we just ripped that idea off completely from the local food community with their help and blessing and started a program called Community Supported Art. It's a partnership with mnartist.org, and every spring we sell 50 shares and we select 9 artists, and over the course of the summer all 50 shareholders get a piece of work from all 9 of the artists. The kind of unique thing that happened after we started that here was that we started getting a lot of interest in it. And so we wrote a toolkit for how to make a CSA program in your community, and now there's about 50 cities that have community-supported art programs. Actually, this week, one launched in the United Kingdom, the first CSA across the pond.
Cool.
So it's been, and the thing that I think is interesting about it, or the learning that I think has come out of it, is not just that, hey, it's a fun thing for people to do, but that there is... there's this huge amount of untapped demand and interest in connecting with local art, with local artists. But we as an arts community are not particularly good at building those on-ramps for people to connect with us. There's a lot that's kind of opaque and intimidating about the arts sometimes. And so this really showed us that there is a demand, that people want to participate, and that people want that relationship.
So again, if it wasn't clear how the CSA works, you basically buy into you say, I'm going to pay this amount of money per month, and I'm going to get a box with a certain amount of food in it, and it's going to have everything from kale to kohlrabi in it, and then that's what I get, because that's what's fresh and in season and local. So the idea is then you get a piece of art, because you paid so much, you get, you know, your box with a certain amount of art in it then every whatever, interval, month, quarter, something. Now, isn't that essentially something that would really only be successful in a community that's already got a lot of disposable income to begin with? Because who is going to do this but people who think, oh, I have $350 to spend on art this month that's going to come in a box, and I don't know what it is.
I got to say that as we watched that program get traction across the country. Some of my favorite programs are in communities that you wouldn't expect. I think one of the best programs in the country is the Community Supported Art Program in Lincoln, Nebraska. They had a U.S. Poet Laureate was one of their artists. I think that the value proposition is that you're buying an experience. It isn't this sort of transactional, I'm paying this much money for this many pieces of art, which, by the way, are usually fairly inexpensive, that value proposition. It's designed to be an entry point. But I think people participate for the same reason they participate in community-supported agriculture. They want that experience. They want to know more about who makes their things. They want that connection to their local economy, to their local community.
Next question.
Thanks so much, guys. I know you were talking about the economic return on creative communities in terms of audiences and the amount of, you know, 3% of GDP, but I know, Peter, you run a music program that is very accessible to everyone, and I'm curious what you guys think about the economic returns of having an arts accessible community not just from the spiritual aspect, but from the actual economic return. I'll use one fact, would be El Sistema in Venezuela, where 3/4 of lawyers and doctors come from the music program, and the music program is accessible to everyone in it. So it's not a, like you were saying earlier, Steve, just for privileged children.
Great question.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind about this conversation, that it's not just people who have disposable income that are kind of supporting the arts community and who are involved with it. A great example from Walker West Music Academy is a family that I know that first accessed programs at the academy on full scholarship through a Ramsey County Children's Collaborative program called Project Voice, which targets disparities and gaps for African American families. And this family is a single mother, and she has two children, and they got involved in our music programs and are still participating, I think, 6 years later now. And we've fully engaged that family in music education. The mother has taken lessons. We've also employed her. She's worked at several of our summer programs, and now she's one semester away from finishing up a master's degree in arts administration. So, you know, I think, yeah, it's great. You know, I think that's a really great example of kind of, you know, community organization with a very small footprint, because the Academy is a very, very small community music school. But, you know, for that family and for countless other families from, you know, lots of different organizations, it's those kind of stories that maybe you're not going to read about, or maybe you're not going to see the art output that you see from maybe more of the middle income kind of working artists, but it still has a really huge impact.
I also want to point out, so that looking at that particular issue, we have a project in collaboration with Intermediate Arts at the City of Minneapolis called Creative City Making. And it's actually a project that works inside of the Department of Long-Range Planning in the city. And it's intended to address underserved communities in long-range planning, so that we have found in the city is most people don't have the time to come to after-hours meetings to talk about plans in their community. So we have engaged artists for the entire year to go into 5 different plans, including transit plans and small area plans and comprehensive plans, to help engage the community so that their voice can be heard. So looking at it in that way, while this isn't about music, it's about community engagement. It's about helping us get, the city especially, get out of this paradigm of just meetings into things like meeting the people on the street and finding out what they want in their plans. So, and the return on that particular investment has been tremendous. We're still working on inputting all the data, which planning hasn't had before. So it's, one thing about the arts is its facilitation role in the community is huge, where you get people who have difficulty showing up at events, arts go out and engage those people. Or where you have difficulty with people understanding or communicating, you have ways in which arts can go to festivals and do that, or tweet and do that. So it's actually the role of arts as facilitator in the community for community's voice. It should not be underestimated.
Next question.
So I'm thinking of music specifically, but I think it can apply more broadly to arts. It seems like there's sort of a black hole somewhere in Brooklyn that sucks in all music from elsewhere in the country. and I'm wondering, you know, one, do you think it's inevitable that starting musicians need to and always will move to New York if they want to, you know, move beyond Minneapolis? And if it's not inevitable, what would it take for Minneapolis to become more of a place that artists move to make a name for themselves more broadly?
Is that me or you?
I think a lot of people do move to the Twin Cities for its art scene. I think maybe that's more a regional phenomenon. But I know countless musicians who moved from Duluth or Fargo or Aberdeen, South Dakota, seems to have a very strange, connection to the cities. And, you know, speaking to kind of how Brooklyn or maybe other, you know, arts and culture scenes kind of draw people, I think there's a benefit now more than ever of kind of staying in the community that you're a part of and maybe trying to build from it, so long as there's some amount of infrastructure there. I mean, I think there's a lot more opportunity probably in the Twin Cities than there is, you know, moving to Brooklyn and, you know, kind of hashing it out with the 50 other bands that move from wherever else in the U.S. that they're moving from. So I think, you know, when an environment's not entirely saturated, I think there's a lot more opportunity to kind of build from.
Well, and also you can basically, you know, if we look at the music industry, you can live anywhere technically and, you know, I still have a pretty healthy practice because the internet has made it so that you can communicate broadly, disseminate what you do. And the other, I mean, one of the advantages that the Twin Cities have over cities like New York, which is it's very hard to compete with New York and LA, but I talk to people from those cities quite frequently who say that just living there is a struggle. You know, finding affordable housing, multiple jobs in order to support their work. And so we have an advantage in this region, in second-tier cities, I call them, where we can actually offer quite a reasonable life. You know, the cost of living here is lower, and you can when you can do that, why wouldn't you want to live in a place like this?
David Byrne was talking about why New York is kind of not the creative community that it was once. And he's and the top reason that he cited was rent. Because you just, the environment that created the scene in the 70s is gone, essentially. But then again, that's the gentrification problem, potentially, again. But, you know, who knows? There's, you know, these sorts of things can be addressed by investment and, you know, the subsidies and whatnot, I suppose, too. But, you know, when there's no place to rent for your art space or for your living space, then that's a significant problem. We have a question from Twitter, which is, what are these various organizations and initiatives, what are some of the initiatives that you're talking about doing to ensure diversity in the arts?
I think this is a really important question in the arts community right now, and I think it's frankly something that as a whole community, the arts have not done a particularly good job at. I think that one thing that is excellent about the ecosystem here in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota is that we do have a number of smaller and mid-sized organizations that perhaps are more flexible or are deliberately founded to address a certain neighborhood or certain population, and many of them are doing really excellent innovative work. I think particularly the Center for Hmong Arts and Talent is just an amazing organization that's been able to do a lot with very little. That being said, the majority of our resources and the investment that we're talking about today do not go to those small and mid-sized organizations, and I think that's a problem, and I think ultimately it will be a problem for organizations that can't change and serve and reflect the community in which they are supposed to be a part of and supposed to be an institution for.
Next question. Wait a minute. Where was my next question? Oh, back here. That's right. It's been answered. All right. I'll go over to this gentleman. I know that there's a fellow up front here I'm going to get to.
I think unrelated to my question, I am one of those people who moved from New York, from Brooklyn, here as an artist and designer.
Yeah.
All right. Because of the space and the affordability and all those things. That
are you from there originally? Or you're from New York?
Yeah.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the suburbs, but don't tell anybody.
Right. Oh. Nobody who lives in New York ever came from anywhere else, right?
The CSA model for eating local foods is amazing, and it's great to apply it to the arts community. But when you subscribe to a CSA, you're ostensibly choosing to eat food that's better than the widely available, cheaper food that's everywhere, and I'm wondering what in the arts model, what the cheaper, you know, fast food option is, there is one.
I think that's no offense to anyone in the room, but I think that's put. I think that's buying your art at Target. if you're buying a poster. You know, I love a framed poster as much as the next person. I think there's a pretty similar value proposition. It's about being intentional about the things you fill your home with.
Policy and the Pint sponsor shall not dictate content in any way.
Oops. Or Walmart.
Right.
Could be worse.
No.
I'm sure.
Just a simple joke.
Well, if you thought your sponsors were mad before. Here's my concern. I'll accept that artists aren't the ones causing gentrification, but I think we need to name the people who are, and I think we especially need to name them because they're often on the boards of the institutions that are funding art, and we need to be really serious about that. Richard Davis from U.S. Bank, John Campbell from Wells Fargo are people who are on, for example, the Minnesota Orchestra Board, where they just locked out musicians and lost us a world-class conductor. I'm worried that if we rely too much on institutions, and the answers that we say to what makes art part of the economy is that we need institutional support, that we're gonna produce art that says nothing, because it's designed to say nothing, because it's not supposed to challenge the gentrification that's happening. The best art that I've seen this year has been a youth orchestra marching into US Bank and trespassing to perform there and hope to sway Richard Davis on the orchestra issue. I've seen I Self Divine and Brother Ali perform at occupied homes owned by US Bank. There's been incredible art. Rogue Citizen has produced this incredible visual art for protest movements that have been marching on the banks and demanding equity in the city. And it feels like there's art that wants to say something, and I'm worried that if we rely too much on institutions, we'll say nothing. So how do we get out from under that control of the people who are hurting our economy in a lot of ways?
Fantastic question.
One of the things that, you're absolutely right, because the system we have here really, you know, it's the nonprofit system, to some degree, the 501c model is kind of crumbling. And it was developed around a certain particular historical line and the organizations here. And how people are supporting what they're doing is actually in dynamic change right now. Organizations are looking at the way they get their investors, you know, whether they ever have a board. There's lots of interesting examples out there. But it is a really important question. And what you're talking really about is about the capacity of the artist to speak directly to the community without having this kind of boundary of institution that frames that. And I personally, that's the work that I do as an artist. So I understand that, but one of the things that ties me to having to make an organization to do my work is just, I don't do work that's profitable. I can't make an income from what I do. Therefore, I have to find another way to do that. So either get a job like this or become an institution. So I think it's a dynamic space right now. Laura, do you have any insights?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right to be worried about those things, yeah. And I think we should be calling those things out. I think that, just at a really base level, it's problematic if an organization is not in service of the mission, which should be the art and the artists. Like, you shouldn't be able to divorce those things from each other. You shouldn't be able to run an organization without producing any art for a year, just as an example. I do think, I think that there are new and exciting models emerging. I think artists are leading a lot of that work. At Springboard, we have an incubator program that's the home to 200 artist-led projects, none of which have their own 501c3 nonprofit organization because they don't need to either now or maybe ever. And that works at a certain size in a certain way. I think we need more models like that. And I think we need, to me, this question is connected to a bigger definition and in a wider embrace of who we're considering part of arts and culture and who gets to participate in this community. And I think that connected to the gentrification question, making sure that we are recognizing artists who live in every neighborhood who are of those places as the ones who are qualified to do that work and not depending on outside institutions or infrastructure to sort of decide who gets to be an artist or who gets to say something.
Dovetailing off of this, I want to get the three of you in on the specifically how we have the issue on one hand of boards of arts organizations, as this gentleman was speaking to, being members of potentially a he put it better than I could. You got what he was saying essentially. Of a 1% kind of class, perhaps, and the work that you do, Gulgun, which is not supported by boards of directors, not supported by, I mean, this is taxpayer money that is seeking to make initiatives. So talk about how perhaps both of those things are complementary. Maybe you want to make an argument for yours as being superior. I don't know.
Well, just to be clear, I don't have a staff or a budget in the city. So when he's, I mean, my position is tax funded because, you know, as a position in the city. But the way I work is actually, I'm trying to develop a new model for working. So I don't have a Department of Cultural Affairs that gives away money.
So it's strictly advisory?
No. I actually work with departments to better utilize their resources. So I work collaboratively with departments because we have a very lateral system in the city of Minneapolis. We have a weak mayoral system. So I am in an office that works across departments, and I engage with them to develop whatever program that they want to develop with an arts bent to it. So if they want to market what they're doing, or if they, in the case of planning, if they want to reach different audiences, I'll come in there with an arts focus, and I'll utilize resources, or I'll bring in outside resources to get that done. So I don't give away money in that regard. I actually try to make projects more efficient and collaborative so that more can be done with them. So I don't know if I've answered your question. That's the thing that Laura was talking about. We're looking for new ways in which to engage without having to develop a system to do it or an organization to do it.
Okay.
So I act as like a connector and a silo breaker.
Question here.
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs here, spent 10, 15 years in Brooklyn, saw a lot of things at Brooklyn Academy, Pina Bausch, and just a lot of stuff. And I wonder if one of the things that I have a question a lot is, now, for what it's worth, Minneapolis was declared the second most materialistic city. I who knows where we got this, okay? I don't know. Right ahead of Dallas, what have you.
Right, declared by whom?
You know, it was on the news, and you go, it's one of these Google things, you go search it out, and there's no information, you know, just a study.
It was Mashable is where you found this, okay.
Yeah, it's very dubious, okay, but there it is floating.
All right, we'll accept the premise.
Yeah, exactly. So, but my question is, sometimes you're in a lot of spaces for theater, whatever, and it feels a lot like the audience really doesn't know what they're doing, or whether the walker or something, it just, you know, and I wonder if there's a component in this in terms of a community, in terms of, is there something on that end in terms of, you know, taking an audience to a different places? Because you find that in Chicago with Steppenwolf, it's like, tighten your belt, man. We're going somewhere, and you don't know where we're going. And here, it feels like a lot of audience are going to say, do I like it or do I not like it? Or who should I tell to see it? And I just wonder if there's an audience component somewhere.
I think it depends on where you are. I think that, you know, one of the things that I do think is really exceptional and unique about the community here is the number of socially engaged artists and the work that's coming out of sort of community engaged practice, the work that Intermedia is doing with the city and through their Creative Community Leadership Institute, Pillsbury House, Mixed Blood, Penumbra. I mean, these are great world-class organizations that maybe don't have the support and the audience that some of the larger institutions have, but are doing, to me, that's where Minneapolis and the Twin Cities' sort of unique character of our arts community isn't so much in a great gallery scene or those types of things that some other cities, I think, definitely would beat us at. But that idea of what an artist's role is in their community and their ability to speak truth to power and their ability to question assumptions, to engage their community, to work in their place, I think it is a really exceptional part of being here.
I think we could probably take couple more questions here. We can go to 7:30, a little bit past, since we got a late start. I see one hand over there. Was there any others that were up? So one straight through there. Okay.
Yeah. So I think about arts as kind of narrowly defined as the visual arts, performance arts, music arts, all that kind of stuff. And in the Twin Cities, I think there's a lot of initiative and energy to solve sort of real world problems, whether it's the energy crisis or environmental issues. And for example, organizations like the Twin Cities Maker or the Hacker Space, where a lot of creativity happens, but it's in really more of an engineering-focused creativity, where we could solve real-world problems that maybe give back to the economy in a more direct way than the sort of culturally savvy, oh, we all love each other sort of feel that maybe the arts as we define it now.
That's how I define it.
Right. could give back, which I fully support, but I think there's a greater creativity that we could support. I'm wondering if you think there is room for that in the Twin Cities, or if we need to focus more of that towards the other arts.
Well, that kind of reminds me of the sort of Richard Florida model, that when he talks about, you know, the rise of the creative class, that was the name of the book, right? Something like that. He's not really necessarily just talking about artists. When he talks about creatives, he's talking about IT people. He's talking about, you know, all manner of creatives. He's a much broader kind of definition of that. All right, thank you very much.
Wait.
I was just trying
to think of how do I take that. So I think you're asking, are you asking a question about cross-sector activity? Because I think, I do agree with Florida in that regard. I think everyone's creative, but not everyone can be an artist. And what I mean by that is, to be an artist, you've got to have some kind of skill. So either informal or formal, like you've got to practice at playing your instrument or picking up your paintbrush or weaving your beads. Whatever you do, you've got to be able to do it. And that's where I kind of see the separation. I know many artists who are not creative, and I know many people who are not artists that are creative. There, I've gone and confused you. Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to say is that right now I see a lot of fields breaking down. I mean, in events like Northern Spark, for example, where you see technology mashups with artists and all things in between, I think that's a really interesting and dynamic, again, area right now that I see a lot of activity in. So to answer your question, I don't personally see any much of that differentiation, but I think it's really important for us to put a stake in the ground for skills, because I can't claim to be able to be a painter because I just don't know how to oil paint. But I am teaching somebody a skill when I teach at the U. I know that, and I think anyone who's been a student of arts or been engaged in arts, they know that. Even if you get those skills informally transmitted through familial lines and you're a traditional artist or a craft artist, that's still a skill that you attain and your community recognizes, and that's, I think, where I draw the line. But whether you're creative within that really depends on who you are, whether you're willing to be adventurous, break the bounds, or whatever.
I think when I think about the kind of creative worker kind of idea, I think that artists kind of are that model by virtue of what they do, so that, you know, when you work as a freelance artist and you kind of, or as a freelance musician, you have to be very active in a network, and you have to, you know, parse together a lot of different income sources. You have to be, you know, very good at networking, very good at self-promotion, kind of all these different skill sets. That I think are very applicable in a lot of kind of creative jobs. And I think that kind of in full, that's very different than maybe the model of work for baby boomers. And I think that, you know, it's no longer you just get a job and you have a, you know, a corporate job maybe for an entire lifetime, or maybe make one or two kind of moves. I think we're moving more towards, you know, younger people being kind of more actively engaged in a number of different kind of sectors and different jobs until they kind of settle in. And I think maybe we're looking at a future where, you know, kind of the old model is just fully out, and maybe we're kind of always kind of doing a lot of different income sources. And I think that's part of what the creative worker kind of idea is about for me.
One final question. I thought there was somebody else over here. Oh, right down there. All right, so I'm gonna get to two more and then we're gonna wrap it up.
Okay, so one of the common questions that I found myself wondering about tonight when we were addressing artist engagement and allowing artists to be engaged and invested in the community, that's only a small piece of the pie when we're talking about creating a community that's art-centric. How do we address accessibility for patrons? Because, you know, there may be many patrons that face financial barriers, transportation barriers, things like that, that limit their access to the arts. And how do we address that?
Great question.
I think a big part of it is making sure that you're getting young people engaged in it and kind of creating an environment that they see the value in arts. You know, there's foundations like Youth Prize Foundation, which has a, you know, a youth-led advisory board that actively does arts projects, that actively collaborates with all of their grantees. I think that the more that we can see kind of arts organizations, you know, do more outreach to youth, I think that's going to be really impactful. And I think you see a fair amount of that.
I think, you know, that to me is a sort of multi-pronged strategy. One way to do that, that a lot of people are doing really successfully right now, is taking the art out of those buildings that have those accessibility barriers. So if it's happening on the street and you happen to be walking by, then you don't have to make any of those pre-decisions ahead of time. And then I think there are, you know, organizations that have spaces that produce, you know, say theater in a fairly traditional way, that are doing really exciting things like Mixed Blood and their Radical Hospitality program, where they decided a couple years ago that just the tickets are free. It's free to go there, anyone, any show. And then they've layered on that a whole bunch of other ways of making their work accessible, and it's really worked. And I think you can't look at what they've done and the numbers that they have been able to show since they implemented that and say that those things aren't a barrier.
I'll take one more question here.
A lot of the questions have been really focused on Minneapolis-St. Paul, and then kind of have a question from the suburbs of how we can nourish the arts out there and how we can support them. We've had some public art discussions on how to support public sculpture and things like that out in my community. So some of the barriers and some of the ways to nourish public art out in the suburbs.
What can we do as a state? What are we doing as a state?
Yeah. I think, you know, everything we've talked about today applies to suburban communities. It applies to rural communities. Springboard has an office not only in St. Paul, but in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, that serves smaller communities. And I'm constantly sort of amazed at how similar the challenges are, how similar the conversations are in those places. But I think that, you know, specific to the suburbs, I think a lot of suburbs that were developed around a certain time are now really trying to figure out how to compete when people care about different things. They care about identity. They want to be attached to their place. And how do you kind of, you know, if you live in a community that never built a town center, how do you do that? How do you retrofit that? And I think a culture and artists can be, you know, one mechanism, one tool in the tool belt that helps people kind of see what assets are there already, helps people recognize the beauty and the character of a place, and that they don't need to necessarily import it from someplace else or travel to have those opportunities.
And we're fortunate we have 11 regional arts councils throughout the state, and for more rural areas, they actually have grant-making programs where you or anyone in your community can apply for a project grant, and you know, it's a very straightforward community peer-evaluated process, and you know, that's a way where you as the consumer have direct impact on being able to create a project that you want to see in your community, and then you know, kind of see it to fruition.
I would add to these suggestions by going to your local municipal authority and demanding that they invest in arts, or you know, asking them how they're going to do that. I rarely get people coming to the city and doing that on behalf of arts and culture. Just you know, coming off the street, seeing a council member and asking, how are you going to spend money from the budget on the arts? It rarely happens. Although there, we do have an arts commission that is the acts as an advisory board to the council. There is some limitation on what they can do. So I think you can do it yourself too. You can go ahead and either go to your local authority or go ahead and instigate something yourself. That's the beauty of the arts. Anyone can get started and start something up.
What can we do? My final question. So what do we do? I guess maybe you actually just answered it. Because what I was going to ask was, you know, what do we leave here tonight doing? What do we do as attendees here? What do we do as citizens to be supporters of the arts, and not just by patronizing, you know, going to 7th Street Entry or going to the Guthrie, but in addition to that, what do we do?
Yeah, I think it's talking to your council members, sending letters to your legislators. I think it's you know, getting together with your friends and you know, buying local produce or supporting art. I mean, all the things that we always kind of talk about, do them. I mean, I think that's the way, and I think that's that's going to continue to create young people who can kind of carry forward the really great vibrancy that we have, and I think that's what it's going to take moving forward.
I want to thank our guests, seriously. It's been a lovely program tonight, and it's a great conversation, and it will continue on Twitter. This program has been taped. It will be up at some point at The Current. If you want to listen to it again, it'll be up for streaming. Peter Leggett, Gulgun Kayum, and Laura Zabel, thank you very much for being here tonight. A round of applause for our guests. We'll let you know, as always, about the next forthcoming Policy in a Pint. We have, like I said, very exciting season ahead. We're going to talk about lots of different issues regarding just the state of the state. That's our overarching theme for the season. Really appreciate you coming out tonight. Thanks to everybody here at the Varsity. Thank you to the Citizens League. Thanks to Sean Kershaw. Thanks to my producer, Jane Solinger. Thanks to Ellie Lozoff. Thanks to everyone who's been a part of tonight's show. It's lovely to see you. I'm Steve Seal. I'll be back at the next Policy in a Pint. Until then, I'll see you on the radio tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock. Thank you so much for coming, and drive safely.